Public health has a strict code of ethics, and public media wants your love. From SDPB, today is Thursday, February 13th. This is In the Moment. Senior lecturer Elizabeth Rox Bruner discusses lessons from the COVID-19 pandemic. She talks about redefining the relationship between public health and the public. She says perhaps it should follow the doctor-patient model. Mike Thompson is back with the Supreme Court Roundup. He has three cases for us today. That includes a death penalty case, a habeas corpus case, and one on who gets to define the term exhausted. Plus, a friend from Friends of SDPB joins me ahead of Valentine's Day with a message of love to our supporters. Will you be our Valentine? We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Kara Hetland. You're in the moment, and the news is first. You're in the moment on SDPB. I'm Kara Hetland. We're going to take just a few minutes out of the show today to talk about loving SDPB, what we love about it, and how you can show some love by becoming a financial supporter. Joining me in the Kirby Family Studio is Wade Gamar. He is the Donor Relations Director based in Sioux Falls, working for the Friends of SDPB. Wade, every time I talk to you, I learn something new. So thanks for being here.
I'm excited
to have you in the studio to share your enthusiasm and your love of SDPB.
Yes. Well, and likewise, I'm excited to learn about your love of SDPB. What do you love about SDPB, Kara?
You know, I have been in public media for 35 years. What I love about specifically SDPB is the people. I love the can-do attitude. I love the simple fact that you get to do a lot of things, and no day is like the day before.
That is true.
Right? And so when you're in news, especially, and that is your focus, you have to know a little about a lot of things. But what I like is that we get to dive deeper, and we get to know more, and share more, and do more. And I don't know, call me crazy, but I love the legislative session. Mm-hmm. I love our coverage. I like understanding the why behind certain things. I love the opportunity to just ask, what are you thinking, mm-hmm. right? What do I need to know? What do our South Dakotans need to know? And how does this impact South Dakotans? So what I love about my job are all of the interesting things I get to learn and share and help educate South Dakotans.
Well, I love that because it's so true. I mean, in SDPB in all aspects, whether it's the coverage in peer or local programming, things like In the Moment, South Dakota Focus, we learn about important issues mm-hmm. happening and occurring in our state that we need to, you know, some of them are problems that we need to tackle. Some of them are just conversations that we need to have. And SDPB brings in people from across the state to have those conversations and ask those questions. And right. Yeah, it's really, really, it's an important public service.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And we do it with joy.
Yeah.
There you go. We do it with joy and a smile on our face. That's for sure. You can show SDPB some love, and you can let us know why you love listening to In the Moment by calling 605-443-6963 or go online to sdpb.org.
Well, and this is, we're showing the love a lot, you know, great theme here, showing our love to SDPB, giving supporters across the state an opportunity to share their love as well during our Valentine's Day membership drive. Thanks to a generous match from Milton Chris Carter, mm-hmm. We have any sustaining action adds $100 to SDPB. There are three ways that you can do that, all incredibly simple. If you are not yet a sustaining member, if you become a sustaining member, there you go. That adds $100.
$10 a month.
Exactly.
Make that call.
Could
right
be $5, $10, mm-hmm. whatever it is. So that is one way. Another, if you're already a sustaining member, increasing your monthly gift results in, again, $100 contribution, regardless of how much you increase it. And then last but not least, if you are currently a sustaining member using a credit card, you can switch to an EFT As simple as that. I did that personally on the membership portal, MySDPB. It took me 2 minutes, and it was really, really easy, and access the match as well. So those are three sustaining actions that you can do to access this generous match from Milton Chris Carter.
Be our Valentine, won't you? And go to sdpb.org or give us a call at 605-443-6963. Wade, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Kara Hetland. The U.S. Supreme Court has been busy this season. We're going to take a closer look at a few upcoming cases they have agreed to hear. Mike Thompson is an associate professor of criminal justice at the University of Sioux Falls. He joined Lori Walsh in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio. They begin with a death penalty case, Gutierrez versus Sands.
A little bit of a background on that. This is a death penalty case out of the state of Texas, which frequently makes good on its promise to execute you. So Mr. Gutierrez is trying to avoid the death penalty. With these three cases we're going to talk about, the court has granted certiorari, which means they've agreed to hear them, but they haven't set a date for argument yet, which will be sometime this spring. So he is trying to get his DNA tested.
He's on death row.
He's on death row.
But he wants his DNA tested.
Yep, he's been on death row since 1999 in Texas. And he's trying to get his DNA tested. And it's sort of complicated because he sues under 42 United States Code 1983, which was passed in 1871, and subjects state officials to liability for constitutional violations.
Okay.
So he's alleging that the failure to allow the DNA testing violates his rights to due process. So he was, the evidence at trial was that he and two others had agreed to rob a lady who owned a mobile home park who had allegedly $600,000 in her trailer because she didn't trust banks. So his claim is that he never went inside the trailer. He didn't know the other two were going to kill her. So the other two killed her. He remains outside. Texas has a law. They call it their parties law, that says that it's a very expansive felony murder statute. Felony murder means if I kill somebody in the course of a felony, that can be first degree murder.
Mm-hmm.
And on this one, he's claiming I was outside. I never had the intent to kill anybody, and so. The DNA testing, he wants to subject the evidence in the trailer to DNA testing
mm-hmm.
to show that he wasn't in the trailer at the time of the killing.
Mm-hmm.
And then the argument against that is, at least under Texas law, the argument against that is that's not going to help you. That's not going to acquit you because of our party's law. You were, the robbery's a felony. You're part of that robbery. You're therefore liable for first-degree murder. So that was the initial reason for the denial of the DNA.
But would he still be liable for death? Will he still be subject to the death penalty then?
Well, the question then, so he says, okay, if the DNA testing comes back and shows I wasn't in the trailer, mm-hmm. then I can use that argument to mitigate at a resentence. I can use that mm-hmm. argument to mitigate my role in the murder and maybe avoid the death penalty
sure.
that way.
Yeah.
So he's been litigating it since 2019, been litigating this. The Supreme Court has already looked at Texas's DNA statutes and the testing statutes. Gutierrez has asked the prosecutor several times, can we test it? The prosecutor says no. So the Supreme Court just in 2023 looked at these same statutes. In the Reed case, Rodney Reed, he's also on death row. Supreme Court looked at it and said that he did have standing, that Reed had standing. I got to talk about Reed a little bit to understand this, because in the Reed case, he wanted to show that the prosecution contaminated some evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the contamination, he couldn't show a chain of custody So you got to show a chain of custody at a trial if you want to get evidence admitted. The Fifth Circuit said, you don't have standing, Mr. Reed. You can show an actual injury with the failure. You can show that that injury, the lack of testing, is attributable to the state of Texas. But you can't show that a favorable court ruling would provide you with a remedy. The Supreme Court reversed. Mm-hmm. U.S. Supreme Court said, no. Yeah, those are the three factors to show standing. But court declaring the statute as applied or on its face as unconstitutional, that's going to give him a remedy that'll get him his testing.
Okay.
So he has standing. So Gutierrez, these cases are
here.
so close factually. Mm-hmm. So Gutierrez goes up there, and the Fifth Circuit, he wins at the district court level, trial court level. District court says it's unconstitutional. Yeah. You get your testing. Fifth Circuit says, no, you don't. You don't have standing. You have suffered an actual injury because of the failure to provide testing. The injury is attributable to the state of Texas because it's based on Texas statute. So the Fifth Circuit gets way into the case and says, well, even if we enter a decision declaring the statutes unconstitutional, the prosecutor might choose not to enforce our ruling. Therefore, there's no remedy for this violation.
That bends,
and I'm smiling because
common
sense. I'm not sure how that has any. I think the Supreme Court is going to be, if they aren't, they should be upset at.
Yeah.
Because the Fifth Circuit just basically said, yeah, we'll use your three factors, but we're going to find a way that this guy doesn't get testing.
Yeah.
So it's a really important case, I think, for the DNA testing. And I think the reason the U.S. Supreme Court took it was to tell the Fifth Circuit, that's not what we said in Reed at all.
Yeah.
We said if you declare that statute unconstitutional, that's a remedy that's going to alleviate the injury. And the Fifth Circuit and Gutierrez said, well, yeah, if we enter a judgment declaring it the statute's unconstitutional, then that still won't provide a remedy because the prosecutor might say, you know, I'm not going to enforce a court order. I'm not sure how you get to that conclusion because the prosecutor obviously has an ethical duty to determine the truth.
Yeah,
and the prosecutor doesn't enforce a court order. Is going to be contemptible.
And that's one of the things that's frustrating about this case is the DNA. The evidence exists. This man wants it to be tested prove that he was not in the room when it happened to save his own life.
Right.
And they're like, no, we're just not going to do that.
Right.
If the same thing had happened now, is it because the crime was committed in 1999? That would be the law.
Those statutes still benefit him, even though they were passed after he did the killing. And he's not looking for a judgment of acquittal. He's not looking for this as proof of innocence. And the DNA statute in Texas says you can't get DNA testing if you're only going to use it for mitigation, for punishment mitigation purposes. You can get DNA testing if you want to show that you're actually innocent, but you can't get it if it's just for sentencing purposes. So Gutierrez is saying, I'm not looking to prove actual innocence. Yeah. I just want it for mitigation. And so that runs contrary to the statute.
Yeah. What kind of law is that for?
I don't know. I think so.
Because that's a huge difference. If the difference is between, you know, the death penalty and life in prison, that's a significant thing. And they're saying, no, you can't ask for this just to live.
Right.
It seems kind of...
Yeah. Well, the due process clause says the government can't take away your life without due process.
Yes. Well, there's the word I was looking for. That sounds unconstitutional.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's essentially what it is alleged that Texas is doing, is taking away his life without providing him due process. Yeah.
So you'll really be listening in the arguments for, you know, those references to Reed to the other case to say, you know, yeah, this is what we decided. This is what... you have to continue to abide by because the facts are so close to the two cases.
Yes.
And the Fifth Circuit is like, no, it's different.
I'll really be listening to how Texas is going to try to sustain this ruling.
Yeah.
And I think it's weird which is a legal term. I think it's weird that the evidence was never tested,
even for trial purposes.
So,
and we're still at the point where we kind of don't know what this court is going to do on some of these things.
Right.
So we can say what we're listening for, and then we could hear something entirely different.
Yep.
All right.
With the Reed case out there like that, I just don't see them changing that course, especially this court. To get them to rule on a death penalty case in favor of the inmate, I don't think they're going to back away from that.
All right.
I could be wrong.
Let's talk Rivers and Lumpkin.
Rivers versus Lumpkin. So this one is a habeas corpus case. And these three cases, they involve inmates. So in Gutierrez, using 1983 he's not trying to avoid his conviction, but he is trying to get a resentencing. In Rivers versus Lumpkin, habeas corpus is, of course, a constitutional check. It's in Article 1, Section 9. It means to provide the body, bring the body. It would be an order to a warden of a penitentiary to produce the body in front of the court, and the government would have to show, well, in a habeas case, the inmate has to show that his conviction was unconstitutional in some fashion. So habeas corpus is another way that keeps convictions from being final, which is something the law disfavors. Okay. But habeas corpus was in the 1787 Constitution. It was a big deal that people have the right to petition the court to say, I need to come and see you because what happened to me is unconstitutional.
Okay. Does it literally mean bring the body?
Yeah. Bring the body.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Huh. Well, I was going to say it's a fun
remedy. So back in the post-9/11, 2006, Congress passed a bunch of laws that really restricted an enemy combatant's right to habeas corpus. And the Supreme Court at that point said, nope, those statutes amount to a suspension of the writ, and you can't suspend the writ for that kind of a circumstance. So in the Rivers case, this goes back all the way to 2012 when he was convicted. Just a little how the habeas procedure works. So if I'm convicted at a trial court in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, South Dakota State Court, I can appeal my conviction to the South Dakota Supreme Court. If I lose both places, then I can come back and file a habeas corpus petition in the trial court again, saying, well, some things happened unconstitutionally. A favorite claim is that my attorney was ineffective.
Okay, so, sure.
The habeas petition is filed, and then if I lose in the trial court, then I can ask for permission to appeal that denial. So after that's done, I am still not done because I can go to federal district court and file a habeas petition alleging that my state court conviction is unconstitutional. Okay. And then I can take that as far as the courts will allow. So habeas sometimes gets a bad rap because it keeps things from being final. It keeps things in litigation. But the Supreme Court has fortunately guarded it pretty jealously as part of our jurisprudence. So Rivers, the United States Code has a statute that says you can't file successive habeas petitions.
Okay.
So Rivers files a habeas petition. He's pro se, without counsel, files a habeas petition. And then while that petition is pending, he files a second petition. So the first one hasn't been resolved, and he files the second. The statute, which is in the Title 28 of the U.S. Code 2244, says that you can't, if you present a claim in a second petition that wasn't presented in the first, it's got to be dismissed. The second petition shall be dismissed. If you talk about a claim that was presented in a prior petition, then your second one has to be dismissed. Okay. So there are real stringent standards on me filing a second habeas in federal court. So Rivers is saying, hey, wait a minute. This isn't a second petition because I had one pending and then I filed a new one. So they're really part of the same petition. And you should look at my second in time petition, I guess, as a motion to amend my first petition.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So in the in the second petition, he alleges additional claims to what he alleged in his first petition. And the government says, well, no, the statute is pretty clear that this is a second habeas petition. He's pro se. He'll have a lawyer in front of the U.S. Supreme Court that'll appoint him something, but he has been pro se. Federal courts have a duty.
How often does that happen, that somebody is pro se in front of the Supreme Court of the United States?
Never.
Okay.
The court will appoint someone. Appoint someone to represent him in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. But the other thing about the court appointment of a lawyer in a habeas case is usually a matter of statutory law. So, if you violate the statute and fail to appoint someone, it doesn't create a separate habeas claim, because habeas only gets at the Constitution.
So why do you think the Supreme Court is looking closely at this particular one? Because the idea is not to have just a flood of people saying again and again, I'm coming back. There's a finality to it, and there's a gatekeeping to it. On the other hand, there's something interesting here about successive petitions versus the second petition that they want to hear.
Right.
What do you think that is? This is actually undecided?
Yeah, it's undecided. Yep.
Okay.
And the Fifth Circuit said, no, you can't file that second one. And they said that the trial court was right in dismissing the second in time. I think it's pretty clear from the statute. It says a claim presented in a second or successive habeas application on a claim that was presented, and then it even covers claims not presented. So his second in time petition covers claims that were not presented in his first. I think the statute is pretty clear that it's got to be dismissed and can't be treated as a motion to amend. The only thing I can think of is that district court judges have inherent powers to do a lot of things to balance equities. Mm-hmm. So a district court could say, you know, I am going to treat it as a motion to amend your first petition, especially since you're pro se.
Yeah.
We're giving you, the courts are supposed to give pro se litigants, unless their filings are frivolous, they're supposed to give them sort of the benefit of the doubt on this. I don't know how they get past the pretty clear language of the statute. I think the only way they do is saying the district court can decide these things. The district court has the power in the future to decide whether it's a successive or whether it should be treated as a motion to amend. And then they might send it back to the district court and say, okay, you consider whether it's a motion to amend or whether it's actually a successive petition. Because he doesn't know. I mean, the habeas applicant here doesn't know that distinction at all.
Right. And it gets to this whole idea of people who have already been incarcerated and the legal work that's happening behind bars in their minds, with their lawyers, without lawyers, and in the courts, which I don't think most of us spend a great deal of time thinking about unless it's been part of our lives.
No, there's a lot that goes on in post-conviction law. The other thing is his claim is that the additional claims in his petition he couldn't have known prior to the filing of the first petition.
Okay. Yeah. So he's convicted of child pornography and assaulting his kids.
Yep.
And so now he's saying, oh, there's more evidence that's going to help me here. Is he saying he's innocent? Or do we know?
He said, let's see, between the time he made the first petition and the second, he was able to obtain his file from his court-appointed lawyer.
Okay, yeah. So that's right. He's saying his lawyer didn't do certain things, which is another common...
Very common.
Yeah, argument
Very
for people
common.
Who are convicted.
Yep.
Okay.
Very common.
Let's do one. And this is another prisoner.
Purtue versus Richards.
Okay.
But this is under the Prison Litigation Reform Act, which tries to stop excessive, frivolous prisoner litigation.
Mm-hmm.
This fella claims...
Richards is the prisoner.
His unit manager is Purtue. I think that's how you pronounce it. So he's alleging that Purtue was sexually harassing him. And so Richards would file they call them kites in the prison, just kind of grievances, saying, okay, hey, he's doing this to me, he's doing this to me. And the evidence is that many times Pertu would just destroy the grievance, would just throw it away.
Tear it up, yeah.
Tear it up and throw it away. So the Prison Litigation Reform Act requires Richards to exhaust his administrative remedies, which would mean he would have to subject his claims, his grievances, to the prison for them to be decided on the merits before he could sue in federal court. He's claiming that I can't exhaust my administrative remedies because of Pertu's.
This guy keeps ripping him up.
Right, right. So what he's saying, it's an interesting issue, of course, but what he's saying is that the reason I can't exhaust my remedies is based on the merits of my sexual harassment claim. So the destruction of the grievances shows the retaliation for sexual harassment. So the exhaustion of remedies question, which is a purely legal question, usually, is now, he's claiming, it's now so connected to the actual merits of whether he was retaliated against that I'm entitled to a jury trial.
It's evidence that I'm retaliated against is what he would say.
Exactly.
And he's got kind of an interesting point there on its face.
He does.
I don't know the real situation, but when you say it like that.
So the question is whether he's entitled to a jury trial on his exhaustion claim.
Okay.
When it's so connected to his actual on the merits claim, whether he was sexually harassed, whether the Seventh Amendment allows a trial in that situation. So the lower court said, he does. He gets a jury trial on his exhaustion question.
How does this end up in the Supreme Court?
Well, the government says, no, he doesn't. The Prison Litigation Reform Act doesn't allow that. You can decide this as a judge without a jury, whether he's exhausted his remedies.
So the prisoner says the judge is biased against him.
He
just wants a jury.
He gets a jury trial. He's entitled to a jury trial on the merits of the sexual harassment, whether he was retaliated, whether Pertu actually retaliated against him. The separate issue is he can only get to that jury if he can prove he exhausted his remedies. But he can't prove he exhausted his remedies because of Pertu's retaliation.
Okay. So that becomes an interesting.
It's going to be.
Is there case law for this?
Have it's going to be interesting.
This has to be something that's happened before, and yet no.
No, not with regard to the Prison Litigation Reform Act that I'm aware of.
Okay. Yeah. And when was that passed?
Oh, you have to ask me a question I don't know the answer to. I don't know.
1997.
Okay, 1997.
I'm looking at the brief.
Okay.
42 U.S.C. 1997, does that mean that
No, that doesn't mean...
Oh, that's a number, not a year.
That's a number,
okay, see, that's why we have to check these things. So we still don't know what year.
I still don't know what year it was passed.
What are you going to be listening for in that, in those arguments? What do you think?
I'm going to be listening for how the court's going to interpret the Seventh Amendment in this situation. The court could
remind me what the Seventh Amendment it says. That's jury trial.
We get jury trial in all civil cases where the amount in controversy exceeds $20.
Oh, okay.
So the amount in controversy here would exceed $20.
Yeah. Interesting.
And like I say, he gets a jury trial if he can prove he exhausted his remedies.
Yeah, there's the catch-22 idea of this,
And the Supreme Court might say the judge can determine whether you exhausted your remedies in conjunction with facts you might prove at a trial, and then you're entitled to a jury trial.
That was Lori Walsh's interview with Mike Thompson, Associate Professor of Criminal Justice at the University of Sioux Falls. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Kara Hetland. Public health researchers and epidemiologists do their work in a lab, hospital, or a government building. That means a lot of their work is done out of the public eye. So we're going to explore what public health is, what people think it is, and how officials communicate their work to the public. Elizabeth Rocks Bruner is a biology program coordinator and senior lecturer at South Dakota Mines. And she joined Lori Walsh from the Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City. She discusses how public health conceptions and communication changed during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Well, the pandemic changed our concept of public health and what it means in a really visceral way. Mm. Like, it's no longer sitting in a historical background for us anymore. We lived it. Our community felt it. We're aware of it. We're aware of it as a system. And I mean, this is a taxpayer-supported system, but it's there to ensure our community's health. So it really changed. What I see was that it's our awareness that we have this system with all these different moving parts that's there to help our health and provide care for us, but it's acting upon us. Yeah. And, you know, everything's not left to this individual doctor model that we normally see. And I think whether people liked that and felt assured by that, that care for the community, I mean, that varied.
And we had this race to a vaccine, which I thought at the time was just so impressive to deal with how people came together and scientists were, you know, sharing information And yet we also had this rise of doubts about the vaccine and an outcry about mandatory vaccines and the fear about that and the cry for medical freedom. All these things are sort of happening at the same time. What kind of legacy do you think they'll have?
Well, part of the legacy that I hope it has is part of what I think could come out of us seeing this as a real thing, this public health system. And that is sort of the good news around us seeing this as a real thing, and is that we can grow it into making it our own. That, you know, we can, just like we would expect to have a good patient-doctor relationship, we can have expectations of our public health system, and we can expect to have it be there to take better care of us, and we can have expectations of it. And so that we need to give it guidance and support. So we really need to support our public health system in a way that allows it to provide us better care. And yeah. So if we do see it as this entity that we provide feedback to, then it's going to provide overall better care for us.
What should we expect from our public health system?
Something that our public health system has is a public health code of ethics. And I think this is something that it provides for us. And something that it does is it provides transparency. It provides equity and preservation of individual rights, all while it's trying to combat disease. And it's based on justice, beneficence, and non-malfeasance. So doing good and non-harm. And so I think those are things that we can expect from our public health service, that it abides by those public health code of ethics.
What ways do we give feedback to that system?
Well, we would have to do that through legislation and public health policy.
Example?
You would have to speak to your state legislators.
Yeah.
You would have to talk to your state and senate, or your state senators and your representatives.
Yeah.
And ask for policy changes.
Yeah. So I'm in Pierre today as we're talking. You're in Rapid City. And, you know, we're listening to this happening in real time. Health and Human Services Committee is mm-hmm. discussing some things. And that is a healthy public debate, which serves as feedback to a public health system. Do I understand what you're saying there?
That is correct.
Where are the balances between, you know, collecting information from people, for example, and then protecting privacy, and the balance between giving people information versus telling them what to do?
Those are the finer points of public health policy, and we decide those as a community together.
Help me understand, because politics comes into this so much, and that is not necessarily, I don't say that is a bad thing necessarily. I mean, it can be a bad thing. But if it's a public conversation, that's often a very good thing. What's bad is when the facts get set aside, or when there's just so much passion that it overruns any kind of reality or ability to care for one another and help one another. You know, how do scientists view that? How do they sort of stay out of the passionate part of this and yet return again and again to the science, especially when you watch maybe the science get run over and perhaps ignored?
Well, I can talk to you about how this is viewed from a scientific view. Science and society have an inherent need to have trust. There is a foundation of trust that's needed there. Scientists would need to lean on their training from very early in their first semester of their training as scientists are taught about scientific method and the ethics surrounding science. And so as scientists professionally, they would have that gut check on, hey, if you are not following the scientific method, you are not acting as a scientist. So there is that initial gut check ethically. We also, as scientists, have usually annual, but not always annual, trainings. And so there would also be sort of the head check, not just the gut check, of knowing when you're crossing those boundaries and following those.
Yeah, that training becomes really important.
So
yeah.
You have training to lean on as a scientist. And it is expected within the scientific and medical community that you follow those codes of ethics that I mentioned earlier that the public health field has, and that you do follow the research ethics and ethics in the scientific community. So when we have different meetings and proceedings within those fields, there is that expectation that you follow those.
Therefore, the communication between scientists and the communication between scientists and the public becomes incredibly important.
Absolutely.
And we are seeing, you know, the early days of a changing administration. Of course, you know, this particular transition appears to be very fast moving. I think that's fair to say, with, you know, some of the announcements that we're seeing. And we're seeing a decrease in communication from the federal public health system. How are we to process, you know, the impact of smooth communication going forward? What would you want to weigh in there?
Well, I think that there is I wanted to weigh in on this in the sense of connectedness. I think there is an issue to bring up when it comes to responsibility and connectedness at the global, federal, and local regional levels that I could address just generally.
Yeah, please.
And I think when it comes to acting with global responsibility, we could look at our role that we play communicating with the WHO, for example, you know, in a public health sense. On a more federal level, we could talk about our responsibilities speaking to the American public about different public health issues, tuberculosis outbreaks in Kansas, for example, or bird flu. And again, we're in a transition time, but we still need to think about what our responsibilities are. Locally, I think we all need to, public health-wise, and just personally think about our interconnectedness when it comes to speaking to each other and being part of our communities, sort of short-term thinking about how can we participate in our community and do things that still energize us and make us part of that community. And then longer-term, how do we reach out and community build?
Are there ways that you see that happening in South Dakota that you feel really good about, that interconnection, that being part of a community and building a stronger, more vibrant public health system?
I think as far as any particular event, it doesn't really matter what the particular event is, as long as the person feels engaged.
Do we learn about the role of AI and social media and the role of just a changing world and how it can very quickly impact science communication, for example?
As far as the role of AI, I think people are going to be using AI and social media very cautiously and very, depending on the AI tool, very carefully. Again, with any tool, depending on how it's built and the algorithms going into it, it's only so useful. If you're using a tool that you don't know what has gone into it, no matter how good the data that you're putting into it, you don't necessarily know what you're getting. So I think some people are going to be very wary on how they're using AI.
Because some of those, the back door of it, and that's not the technical term by any means, but in my mind, you know, how that AI tool works is sometimes proprietary, and the people who made it don't want to tell you, nor would even someone with your education understand the coding behind it, perhaps. And so then it becomes a matter of trusting. And that's not the scientific method, is that
correct? It's like, it all depends on how it's been trained, how the AI has been trained. And that may not necessarily be the best way to go about what you're doing. Also, you know, as far as communication goes, when you're using social media that's not being fact-checked, to my understanding, there are going to be some notes about the authors, but, you know, who knows what the standardization around that will be. And you have AI out there, and you're trying to communicate as an epidemiologist or public health person, there's a lot of chance there for miscommunication. And that's a real issue out there for some troublesome hurdles as well.
Yeah. Can you tell me why there would be a tuberculosis outbreak? That seems very, I don't know, England in the 18th century to me. I'm not laughing at the outbreak. I'm just saying, what's going on?
Well, there's not a lot of information getting out about what's going on. But basically, if you have highly contagious bacterial infection, and you have the right conditions, you can have that type of outbreak. So we're all looking forward to getting more information.
And similarly with the avian flu, bird flu, to humans, to domestic cats, to, you know, flocks and the price of eggs and all, this is converging to be a very complex story. What are some of the key takeaways about how we're seeing avian flu spread and develop?
Some of the key takeaways would be that there isn't a lot of communication going on, and to go to the sources that you know are good resources. Go to Department of Health web pages that you can get information from, primary journals when there are publications.
Right.
You know, so go to those good resources when there is information, so you know that you're getting good information. That's always a good key place to start. Know that there is cross species jumping. And to be aware that is happening, so to keep yourself safe and to not expose yourself.
Yeah, there, you know, lack of information can have a pretty big impact on individual lives and on public health.
Yeah, so don't underestimate the power of just a little preventative education. You know, there is a little bit of truth to some of those old sayings, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So. They sound a little old-fashioned, but there's really something to some of those.
And to the scientific method.
And to the scientific method, yes.
As we wrap up, are there other things that you think are really timely right now that we should be paying attention to here in South Dakota, specifically about public health?
Specifically in South Dakota, something I'd really like to see not slip through the cracks is attention to maternal health and the need that we have here to really get action. We've had OBGYN units in winter closed down recently. We have large areas where women don't have access to care readily. But also we need information surrounding not just births, but also prenatal care and postpartum depression and all sorts of demographics surrounding maternal health. And I would really like to see that not slip through the cracks. So if there was just one issue that I could just have time to mention, it would be that one.
That was Lori Walsh's conversation with Elizabeth Rocks Bruner, PhD. She's a biology program coordinator and senior lecturer at South Dakota Mines. It is now time for us to take a break and talk a little bit about why we love SDPB. I'm Kara Hetland, and joining me in the Kirby Family Studio is Wade Gaymar. He is the Donor Relations Director based in Sioux Falls with the Friends of SDPB. Thank you for coming in and talking today.
Thank you so much for having me. This is fun. This is exciting.
So I'm going to ask you some questions. Why do you love SDPB?
That's a big question, Kara. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of reasons why I personally love SDPB. I love that it, so I really like to learn. I consider myself a lifelong learner. And I love that whether I'm watching TV, I'm tuning in on the radio, I'm reading an article online, I can learn something new. Every single day that I come to work or consume something that SDPB is putting out, I learn something, and I love being able to learn about a lot of different things, and SDPB really like fills that need in my life. So that is one thing that I love about it. I love the team that I get to work with. I love donors from across the state that I get to connect with that have incredible stories and are all passionate, regardless of their background. They're all passionate about the same thing. So there are a lot of things. I could go on and on, but we only have so many minutes here, Kara.
We only have so many minutes, and it is our Valentine's Day week.
Yes.
Days.
Yeah, Valentine's Day membership drive.
And so we're asking you to show SDPB a little bit of love, and you can do that by calling 605-443-6963 or going online to sdpb.org. And if you want your love to last a lifetime, consider becoming a sustaining member. And with that, Milt and Chris Carter will donate an extra $100 on your behalf when you become a $5 a month, $10 a month, $20 a month sustaining member to SDPB. Again, that number is 605-443-6963 or go to sdpb.org.
And there are plenty of sustaining member actions that you can take in addition to becoming a sustaining member. That is one way to access Milt and Chris Carter's generous match for this drive. Another is to increase, if you're already a sustainer, to increase your monthly gift, even if it's by $1, $2, $5, $10, whatever it is. Increasing your current gift accesses this sustainer extravaganza membership drive as well. Or switching, if you're currently a sustainer using a credit card, switching to an EFT through your checking account is also a sustaining action. So that also gives you access to the match as well. And in fact, I did that. It was incredibly easy. I was previously a sustaining member using my credit card, switched over to EFT. It took me 2 minutes on the My SDPB membership portal. It was super easy. And that, as a result, access the match. So it's pretty easy, pretty cool.
Look at me learning from you today.
I know. Pretty neat, right?
It doesn't take long. It doesn't take much.
Not just a pretty face, Kara.
And when you call 605-443-6963 or go to sdpb.org, we have a new SDPB sock.
Yes.
And it is cool, and I want a pair, and you should want a pair too to show your love all of the time. You can't wear them every day, but as often as you could.
Depending on how many you get or, you know, your laundry cycle.
But there's a new SDPB sock with our new logo on it for your sustaining gift of $60, $5 a month. One size fits most. We have about 120 pair. 119, because I'm going to sneak a pair. But these can be yours, and you can show the love and show others just how much you love SDPB. Again, that number, 605-443-6963, or go online to sdpb.org. And that was our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ellen Kester and Ari Youngeman. Our host is Lori Walsh. Our videographer is Jordan Henderson. Our engineer is Colton Nicholson. From all of us at SDPB, I'm Kara Hetland. Thank you for listening.